statutes, commonly known as ORS, and other similar type of things. And please be sure that your cell phones are in off position. Today we're going to be focusing on education mandates, and we're going to be reviewing federal mandates, state mandates, and Oregon administrative rules. We're going to work toward developing three categories of mandates. The first category will include mandates that are critical to a child's safety and educational well-being, such as background checks for employees working with our children. The second category will be technical mandates that will include requirements that are important but do not rise to the level of critical. Such an example would be media specialist in a library. The third category covers those mandates that create a work or financial burden on schools, which benefit does not match the costs. The state of Oregon has over 500,000 children in the educational system. The Oregon State Legislature and the local school boards are responsible for the education and safety of those children. During this session, I will be, and I know that we all are collectively, dedicated to finding funds that can be utilized in the classroom and create a safe environment for our children. Our next step will be looking beyond special interests and concentrating our combined efforts to the safety and education of our children. With that,
Madam Chair, I would like to make a donation in honor of our newest official member of the committee.
Oh, and please, I am remiss. Thank you in not welcoming our official member of the committee, Mr. Arnie Roblin. Welcome. Thank you. You became a fixture, and I just kind of slipped my mind. I do apologize.
Okay.
And welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Welcome.
It really is both a pleasure and an honor to be on this committee. It's an important part of my life, and I look forward to working with all the people here. It's been impressive working with you, sitting one seat down coming as a member, and I appreciated your graciousness and willingness to let me be a part of it before. So I am really pleased now. So thank you.
Very good. And anything else you care to add by way of personal background, other than we know you have an extensive history?
Many people know I was hired in Coos Bay as a math teacher in 1972 and finished my career at Marshfield High School in the same school I began 32 years later as the principal the last 15 years. Along the way, I had a lot of opportunities to do a lot of different things. Bowley took us on a tour of Germany with schools and vocational schools. I had the opportunity to receive the Milken Award and a number of other things in education. So it's been my life, and it's really important for me to be able to continue to offer some things and to offer back to the community. I've always thought of myself as a servant, and when I've been invested in for so long, it's nice to be able to serve and give back again in a different way, and this is one place to do that. So it's been great to sit here and watch people I've known for a number of years in different roles. So I really do look forward to it. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, and welcome again, and thank you, Representative March, for that gentle reminder. As we begin our informational discussion about mandates, I would invite John Marshall and Chuck Bennett forward. Do you want to come separately or individually? Separately or individually? Or collectively?
Or both of you.
Or both. One or none.
Okay, I vote for none.
Okay, shall we start this over?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And I appreciate the opportunity to begin your discussion of mandates. And I wanted to try to put this whole topic into some form of context. You recall when I first visited with you, I talked about the constitutional requirement and the duty upon the legislature to provide for a uniform and general system of common schools. Since statehood, in your fulfilling your constitutional duty, and particularly the duty of creating uniformity, you have set up a statutory scheme to impose certain requirements on school districts. And that is a part of to assure uniformity throughout the state, and I believe it gets back to the issue of assuring equity That is the requirements on school districts from Bend to Burns to Bandon to Beaverton ought to be uniform in terms of the requirements imposed. The chart that I've given you tries to lay out the number of mandates and or requirements that are imposed on school districts and education service districts, hereinafter referred to as ESDs. You see from you start at the top, and the state has imposed both statutory and administrative rule mandates on school districts. The statutory mandates are educational, and those are the statutes that you'll probably become most familiar with in terms of requiring certain duties and functions of school districts. But there are also other statutory mandates imposed on school districts. We're required to comply with the local budget law. Just like units of local government. We're required to comply with the municipal audit law, just like units of local government, and so forth, and I'll lay out some of those in a little bit. On the other side of the chart are the administrative rule requirements that come onto school districts, both educational in nature, and those primarily are from the Department of Education, but there are other administrative rules with which school districts must comply. For example, administrative rules from the Bureau of Labor and Industries regarding wage and hour, administrative rules relating to providing workers' compensation benefits for our employees, and so forth. So those are sort of the four different ways that these requirements come to school districts from the state. And then off to the side there, you see the federal mandates imposed on school districts. And certainly, if you'd ask school officials what are the largest federal mandates that are imposed, they would say No Child Left Behind, certainly, and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the requirement that we provide educational programs and services to students with disabilities. There are other, however, federal mandates imposed on school districts. For example, through the IRS code, that is, when school districts issue bonds, before those bond proceeds are expended, we're prohibited from investing those proceeds and earning money. That's called arbitrage, and that's prohibited under federal IRS code. So that's just one example of a federal mandate. Another has to do with student records, individual students' rights to privacy. All of those come to us from the federal government, either through statute or administrative regulations. And then from the bottom up, we have mandates or requirements imposed on school districts by city, county, and special districts. An example of county requirements, we have to comply with local land use laws. We can't just build school districts wherever we want to. They have to be within the urban growth boundary, and so forth. City requirements on school districts. We have to, to build a school building, we have to comply with city building codes. Oftentimes, to build a new school building, we are required to make street sewer improvements and so forth. And the special district requirements are pretty much the same relating to those kinds of utilities. So you can see that the requirements on school districts are not just those statutory mandates over which you have direct control from the state level, but they're also administrative rule mandates from a variety of different agencies, as well as federal and local. On the back, or on the second page, I've tried to lay out those statutory mandates in terms of those that we define as educational, as well as the other requirements that are imposed on school districts. We've got financial accounting and record-keeping requirements. We have reporting requirements about students' programs and so forth. Programs and curriculum requirements, health and safety, and other operational requirements that I would define as educational. And then the other category are those statutory mandates or requirements relating to open meetings, public records, municipal audit, local budget law, health and safety issues, building codes, elections, collective bargaining, and so forth. So those, I think, give you a pretty good example of the other kinds of statutory mandates or requirements that are imposed on school districts. The last page, you've all seen, I believe, the document that was prepared that lists all the statutes, and I think that somebody did a word search of the Oregon Revised Statutes and came up with a list of every place it says school districts are required to do something. It lists those out. And what we've done is taken that list and tried to narrow it down to the major requirements that fall within those categories that I described as educational mandates. And you can see they're laid out by category. Some program mandates, for example, requires Arbor Week observance, requires women in history, earthquake emergency drills under health and safety, and so forth. And I think if you begin by looking at some of these requirements, you would argue that they provide a value relative to their cost. I don't think any school district official would suggest somehow that, well, the fire drill or earthquake safety drills are so onerous that we don't want to do them. I think there's an argument that can be made that they're of value. Obviously, for each and every one of these, there was at one point in time a constituency that suggested that this was extremely important. I remember in particular Women in History Week. There used to be a statutory requirement that school districts take some time during the school year to honor Frances E. Willard. Frances apparently was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, who made a name for herself, I guess, going into saloons with an axe and busting up kegs of beer. And there was a suggestion at one time that Frances E. Willard Day be removed as a mandate whereby schools provide some degree of instruction about the contribution Frances made to Oregon history. Well, the hearing room was full of these folks that were either friends of or remembered Frances, and as a result, the committee at the time was a little reluctant to totally remove Frances from the statutes, but moved towards broadening the discussion of the contributions of women to Oregon history and made it Women in History Week. So, again, I think there are obviously reasons for each of these. Some, I think, are more valuable, perhaps, than others. But hopefully this will give you some context by which you can think about mandates and those requirements imposed. Over the course of my experience, we've been pretty successful in discouraging the legislature from enacting new mandates, particularly in the curriculum area. There are always those that believe that schools ought to focus instruction in particular areas, and those bills start off with the word school district shall, and we've been successful over the years in changing that through the legislative process to one where school districts are encouraged to or school districts may. So with that, I'd be glad to respond to any questions and look forward to working with you as you take on the issue of mandates and those that do in fact impose a burden, those that may or may not impose the legislature's will on what should appropriately be left to local school boards and local school officials in their own communities.
Thank you. Representative March?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to risk, I'm not going to touch the women in history one, given our chair's gender, but the requires Arbor Week observance and activities. Do you have any idea of the dollar cost of that particular curriculum program requirement?
Madam Chair, Representative March, oftentimes some of these curriculum requirements, for example, Arbor Week, the National Arbor Foundation provides to individual schools instructional materials. Oftentimes students will plant a tree in the schoolyard. There's obviously some educational value to understanding the importance of trees and their whatever they add to the environment and so forth. So I think you weigh that requirement and the benefits, the educational benefits, against the costs. 2 years ago, Representative Morgan, who chaired the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, we did quite a bit of work on trying to drill down on these mandates. And we did a survey of school folks, and we asked them them to gauge the cost of the mandate versus the benefit. And most of these, there was a cost, but there was also a benefit, as the chair suggested, that was outweighed by the relatively minimal cost there may have been.
So basically, these kinds of things are, for the most part, relatively minimal cost then?
Representative March, I would say for the most part. Now, you look at, one of the student services, for example, requiring home-to-school transportation. That's very, very expensive. Granted, the state provides some 70% reimbursement for that. One would argue, well, we have that ought not to be a mandated service. On the other hand, one argues that it's important to assure that kids get to school, that they're transported so as to avoid any kind of safety, traffic hazards, and so forth. The talented and gifted mandate, the one that requires us to provide services to talented and gifted students, that's expensive. But one would argue that those students on the sort of the upper end of the scale deserve the programs and services unique to their needs, just as those kids on the lower end of the scale. So while one could go down through here and identify those mandates that cost the most, one could also argue that they provide the greatest benefit as well.
Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Madam Chair, I had a question regarding the mandate requires identification of and provision of programs or services to talented and gifted students. Now, we had a presentation from the Department of Ed just a week ago that said there wasn't a mandate requiring school districts to provide those services. I guess that was more a comment than a question. Would you speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I look here and it says requires identification in a specific ORS statute. And I recall several sessions ago where there was discussion about repealing that mandate. And as you can imagine, the hearing room was full, as were your email and voicemail boxes. I'm pretty darn sure that's a mandate, but
I think that context of that discussion was in regard to what Oregon Department of Education was required to contribute or create, rather than the statutory requirement for school districts.
Thank you.
That might help a little bit, and that was my limited understanding, Representative Roseland.
To that point, Chair. When they talked, they said there's a requirement that we identify and we have to be able to test them. So that is an expense. That's still required. There's also a requirement to have a plan, but the plan does not need to be submitted in. So they have to have a plan. The plan doesn't come to ODE. So they're required to have a plan. They're required to identify. But that plan can be just about anything. And what they provide will differ from school to school, in my opinion.
Representative Dolan.
Is there any requirement to implement the plan? I guess I'm not sure. Talking to Representative Roland, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Excuse me, but I don't think there is.
I'm not sure if there is either. We did.
Well, how about this? Salam Noor, would you like to come forward and address this specific question at this point?
Of course.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor from the Department of Education. And relative to the question that Representative Farr just raised, the districts are required to develop a plan and identify and serve students that have been identified as TAG students, but they're not required to submit that plan to the Department of Education unless they are applying for state and federal funds. So they still have a responsibility to identify those students and serve them at their rate and level.
Thank you.
I have a question for you, Mr. Marshall. The K-12 mandates that you've listed on your second sheet there, I also have a list of K-12 mandates that Mr. Keller had provided with us which is a number of sheets, and then I also have a significantly thicker listing of Oregon administrative rules. Would you care to make comment about the impact of the administrative rules, how that weighs in this whole discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. The legislature passes a statute and then expects the Department of Education to implement that statute. And oftentimes the statute itself doesn't have the specificity nor the clarity that school districts would need to comply with this statutory directive. So the Department of Education then adopts an administrative rule to give the specificity to school districts in terms of what they're expected to do or not do under that statute. The Department of Education and the State Board of Education specifically is granted broad authority to adopt administrative rules based on their view of the statute and how the State Board believes that school districts have to respond to those statutes as well as other requirements that the State Board itself comes up with. So the statute starts off, as I think you can show, relatively thin, and then the administrative rules giving effect to those statutes become much broader.
Any additional questions for Mr. Marshall? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, maybe the tighter question would be, are there any specific statutory mandates or specific Oregon administrative rules that have been particularly onerous that we should look at changing, modifying, or removing, or alternatively funding adequately?
Next hearing.
Madam Chair, Representative March, if you were to ask local school officials, and maybe Representative Dallin can help me if I get dig myself in too deeply, it seems to me that many of the administrative rules that come from the Department of Education deal with various and sundry reporting requirements. And I think there have been questions raised over the last several years about the magnitude of some of those reporting requirements and the fact that oftentimes the Department of Education, one section will ask for data or the form or questions on a survey or other information that another section of the Department of Education has already asked for. And I know that there's been some effort, particularly since Superintendent Castillo came on, in an attempt to try to identify that duplicative, those duplicate paperwork requirements and try to get a handle on them. I know that during the last interim, Randy Harnish, the executive officer for the State Board, wanted to put a group together to begin to go through the administrative rules and identify those that were absolutely necessary and those that could possibly be eliminated or modified in some way to lessen that burden on school districts, because I think of other activities that we never got around to doing that. But I believe that, again, if you talk to school folks, they'd say most of the administrative rule requirements from the department that are particularly onerous are the requests for reports and data and so forth, and trying to figure out how we can satisfy both the accountability requirements of the Department of Education, the State Board, as well as the federal government and the legislature to assure accountability, is how can we get the information we need from school districts in terms of how they're spending the money versus burdening them overly with more forms and more requirements.
Thank you.
Well, in regard to the OAR, Oregon Administrative Rules, that are, it has already been used, it's out there, that are used to implement the legislation, how do we know that they actually meet the legislative intent?
Madam Chair, to compliment the Department of Education, in the years that I've been around, the department has always been very good in putting together work groups. For example, the legislature passes a statute that requires implementation by the department. They're very good about bringing in interested parties to take a look at the administrative rules, and we do a pretty good job, those of us in the K-12 community, in keeping the, for lack of a better term, keeping the department honest in terms of making sure those administrative rules don't go beyond their statutory authority. So I think the department has done a good job in terms of that aspect.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bennett?
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Chuck Bennett, and I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. John has given a really encyclopedic review of this. We were involved together during the last session in our review with Representative Morgan and Representative Tootie Smith in going through a whole variety of mandate discussions throughout the session. What I think came across for me most surprising was statutorily the lack of cost associated with statutory mandates. What it was consistently surprising when we would hit a mandate and try then to figure out an associated cost, how little money we could really get our hands on going into the statutory area. Perhaps different, and I have to admit I've not been through a review of Division 22 rules to determine what the costs associated with those looks like, and I'm not sure there is a really good complete review. The best I've seen, and I'm sure you'll hear about it later, is some work done by the Greater Albany Schools, and I know there's other districts taking a look at Division 20 rules and trying to get a handle on that. As you discuss that area, I think the one thing, I'm not sure it's the one thing, but one thing that would be very helpful would be very clear fiscal impact statements from the Department or Board of Education as they look at these rules, that there be a more involved interaction with local districts on any kind of fiscal impact that might be associated with adoption of Division 22 rules. In addition, just sort of as a kind of a personal reaction to these, one of the things I've been doing education lobbying only for, this will be my third session, and one of the things I found difficult about it is with the mandates that come to you statutorily is coming in front of committees consistently negative about various kinds of programs that, while on the face of them have an extremely positive sound to them, also have often associated costs. And as John mentioned, he and his colleagues, including myself over the years, have been very successful in stopping expensive mandates, which is part of the reason you don't find a lot of them in the statute. You will be confronted with a batch of them again. We'll be back in saying, please don't support this. We'll be trying to find fiscal information for you on them. We hope you'll look very closely at them. In addition, you'll hear in other committees, probably not in this one, other issues that come before you, whether it be systems development charges, which are costed against schools as they build buildings and become substantial costs for us, increased building code costs as those are developed, the impact of land use planning, this indirect area that John mentioned can become substantially expensive, particularly if you're going to be doing any kind of new construction. I brought along a copy, and I'll supply it to the committee. Just as an example, I had been contacted by Sherwood School District, which was looking at expanding its high school stadium. And they ran through, and I'll leave this a copy of this with you, ran through the impact of changing building codes requirements on toilet stalls as they try to build a new stadium. And what happens over the years as this begins to increase to where you see where if we were able to operate Under the 1997 Oregon Structural Code, there would have been 27 required stalls in a stadium of 3,000 seats. They now will have to add 58. And this is the kind of thing that becomes a real concern to a school district as it's trying to do a building. In addition, the superintendent made a note to me that, and recall, it's not just the construction of the additional toilets in the stadium. There is a public reaction to, what are you doing with all these toilet stalls in this stadium when I'm having problems with Johnny Reading, and then you've got SDCs of $2,000 per additional toilet that goes on. And this is the kind of stuff that becomes very expensive. It has a public relations component, and I think it gets overlooked. And I think sometimes we overlook it as well as you all, and I just wanted to be sure to underscore it, because I think it's the kind of just nuts and bolts problem that school districts run into that can be overlooked in favor of discussing whether or not we should continue Francis E. Willard Day. And really, it's not the, those are not the issues that really are affecting them. It is in building codes and other areas like that. So I just appreciate the opportunity. Really look forward, if you decide, Madam Chair and Committee, to go into this area in great detail. We're really looking forward to working with you on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dolan.
Yes, Chuck and John, either one of you. When we talk about cost, there's two things that I think. One is money and one is the time. Do you have any idea of how much time is involved with a classroom teacher in preparation of the gifted and talented plan?
No.
Do you have any idea of how much time is involved with the requirement to do ethics and morality instruction? And do you have any idea of how much time is involved with identification for Arbor Day? And I think that might be part of the issue, is time is as precious in the classroom as dollars are in the district office.
Right.
So when we talk about onerous rules from this body, it's what you're doing to that classroom teacher that makes things so expensive. I believe in some schools, we heard the other day they were allocating an hour and 20 minutes to reading. Well, if you take some of that time away to develop the gifted and talented folder, and there is no requirement that you implement the plan, just a requirement that you have a plan. And that means the teachers must be involved in that implementation or drafting, but not necessarily implementation. So what I would like to know is, on these regulations besides dollars, which are very difficult to get your arms around or your hands around, what kind of time we're impacting in the classroom when we do these sorts of things?
Madam Chair, Representative Dellum, I think you're making a very good point relative to the classroom teacher, and I think as you look at broader issues, the same thing happens in the central office as well, as you begin to deal with planning and coordination activities, curriculum development issues, et cetera. I ran into one today, and it's one of these you kind of track these mandates or potential mandates by sometimes almost by rumor. But whether or not we will see developing a series of planning and implementation mandates or rules or some other area around the entire issue of P16 or P20. How will that develop? How will the State Board of Higher Ed, or the combination of the two, begin developing that kind of planning regimen, and how will that come together, particularly when you're in somewhat in the absence of a real clear statutory policy direction? How are these things being developed? And having sat through the last couple of years of discussions of those kind of educational continuum issues, it's very clear that we're on a course that may not have a full policy direction, but it's going to require a tremendous amount of rulemaking as well as planning activities at the local level. And it has never been through a full policy vetting at this level. So I think there's lots of these kinds of discussions to be had. I agree with you. And they do take time, as you know.
Any further questions? Thank you. Representative Lynn.
So as I look at this K-12 mandates, I counted about 44 mandates in here. It looks like everything is looking good, and we are trying to streamline the system, but there is no recommendation what needs to be changed. And so I need to find out how could we make our education system better by streamlining, eliminating some of the rules and statutes that could be improved our education system. And with that, can I ask one question here? That require display of a U.S. and Oregon flags and student salute opportunities. Could you explain what that is?
Representative Lim, there was a bill that passed, I think, 4 years ago, or two sessions ago, that required students to be given an opportunity at least once a week to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was asserted through testimony that not all classrooms had an American flag. And so the combination of requiring that all classrooms have a flag and that students be given an opportunity to say the Pledge of Allegiance at least once a week was a statutory requirement.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So it is enforced at this time of this statute. Are they doing it every week, at least once a week, allegiance to the flag? Do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I don't know specifically every classroom and every school district in the state, but we certainly, in our work, made clear to our folks what the new statutory requirement was, and I think that the school administrators organization did as well. So I'd like to think that schools across the state are complying with that statutory requirement.
Okay. One more follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
There has been an issue that the student or a teacher displayed the Mexican flag some time ago in the classroom, not in our state, but all the state. That has been an issue. And what happened if someone displayed the flag of Mexico, flag of Japan, or any other flags in the classrooms? Is that against the law at this time?
No, I don't believe so.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Lim, I will affirm for you that there are schools that do not allow or have the time scheduled to have the flag salute at least once a week, as required by law. Okay. And I have been contacted by folks to that regard. They are not doing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pat Fedor from Albany. We understand you're doing some interesting work.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat Bedore. I'm superintendent of schools for the Greater Albany Public School District in Albany, Oregon. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for your interest in K-12 education. Albany is a school district of between 8,500 and 9,000 students. We have over 900 employees. We have a 5-member school board. Albany is a healthy district, a strong district. It's, in my opinion, just the right size. And we have issues dealing not just with curriculum. I came here prepared to talk about the Oregon Administrative Rules in Division 22, where we've done some work that has been noticed, but our enrollment is climbing, and we are facing facilities issues. And Representative Dahlem made a comment about teacher preparation time and the time it takes to get ready to deal with a particular topic. I find myself needing to get ready to deal with the topic that I never learned about when I took superintendent training, and that is building a new school. So recently I have found myself in workshops with city planners and developers and architects about school siting and all of the criteria around that. My point is, while I'm doing that, I'm not focusing on reading and math instruction in my district, but it has to be done. During the 2003 legislature, a local senator who was a freshman senator at that time, Frank Morris, approached me and asked, what can the legislature do for schools short of coming up with more money? And I asked the senator if he were aware of the mandates in Division 22, and I'm talking about the Oregon Administrative Rules. He was not. So I prepared a list for him of the particular mandates within Division 22 that the staff in Albany felt could be considered for waiver that would be helpful to school districts. And I believe you have a handout that says Greater Albany Public Schools at the top, Division 22 considerations for amendment or waiver. This is very similar to the list we developed in 2003. And what we did was take each rule and include a recommendation for how that rule could be changed to allow us to be more efficient. I was here 2 years ago and testified before a committee, although I don't think I remember any of you on it, possibly some of you were, asking just for alignment between the mandates from the state of Oregon and the now new mandates from the federal government. By virtue of No Child Left Behind. We ask that the Certificate of Initial Mastery be limited to those same areas for which we were held accountable in No Child Left Behind, reading, math, and science. Nothing changed about the Certificate of Initial Mastery last year, or 2 years ago. So this year, we have a freshman representative in our area, Representative Andy Olson, who has taken an interest in these unfunded mandates, and because I believe he's working on a bill with Representative Boquist, he came back to us and said, we need to present the fiscal impact of this before this bill can ever go anywhere. So inside your handout, after the list of rules and the recommendations, you'll find a letter to Representative Olson listing some of the rules and what we estimate to be their financial impact. Following this letter, Representative Olson did talk to our local newspaper about how this could generate an amazing windfall of savings to our district and to our budget. And in fact, I called him and said that isn't exactly what we meant. This doesn't really result in a windfall of savings, and I'll explain to you why if I could. If you look at the rule 581.022.0405, career education, it's on the front, the first page of the letter, and it's the first rule that we attempted to assign a fiscal impact to. So it's about our elementary schools teaching career education. So this is how the thinking went about the fiscal impact of that. If we took the 52 first and second grade teachers, 1 hour a month on career education, now it's not prescriptive how much time is spent, but we just did that for the purposes of coming up with a number. So 52 teachers times 9 months times $30 an hour, that's a total of $14,040. Then we take our 68 teachers in the third through fifth grades. Let's assume they spend 2 hours on career education. That represents another amount of money, $36,000-something. And basically, we consider this worth about $50,000. But it doesn't mean if our teachers didn't have to teach career education that we would have that money back in our budget, because they would be spending those hours teaching reading, math, or science, or social studies. So that's how we came up with the fiscal impact, but it doesn't translate to a windfall of savings. It does, however, allow us to focus and be more efficient, because we're held accountable not for career education. We're held accountable for reading, math, and science. When the Oregon State report card comes out, there's not a report on a district's level of achievement in career education. Or Women in History Month or Black History Month or many of these mandates. The very last document in the handout is the article that was recently in the Albany Democrat Herald following the letter to Representative Olson. I did call the editor of the newspaper to clarify why this was not a windfall of savings. So that's what this explanation is. My request in asking the committee to consider waiving these rules or at least setting them aside for a time, again, is not so that we save money, but so that we can focus, so that we can become more efficient and basically be responsible for the areas in which we're accountable. And this is also about local control. I do want to say that as I've talked with my fellow superintendents about, for example, the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, which really is a pathway for students to enter their year 13 after high school with skills and abilities to go on and be productive, whether it's to higher education or into the world of work. I think that's a marvelous idea, and some of my colleagues are actually putting that mandate in place because they know it's good for kids. So I'm not requesting that we take these away. My request, and on behalf of my colleagues, is that words like required be changed to encourage and shall be changed to may, and let it be local, a local decision. Let the options be locally controlled so that the community and the school boards can work together. I would be happy to stab at any question you'd like to ask me.
Madam Chair. We will have some. Representative Farr, then Representative Dolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If Jim Keller will indulge me, I think he may be able to answer this question, but during the last legislative session, there was a House bill, and I'm pulling this out of my memory banks. I think it was 2144, and it actually did cut down the core subjects for the SIM to, was it three? I thought it was English, math, and science.
It was 2744.
And well, I got three of the numbers right.
The SIM was limited to English, math, and science, and then you get endorsements in the other areas.
So the requirement was English, math, and science, so that actually did change.
Okay.
But you could be endorsed in the other two areas, social science and, was it foreign language? Yeah. Social science and foreign language.
So those endorsements are optional?
So just for the record, I was here during the last session, although I was not a voting member.
Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, Madam Chairman, and if I might, just Superintendent DeBoard. Career education. If it is deemed important in your district, would your teachers teach the material necessary to make career education a viable option? Would the teachers do it?
Representative Dolan, if I understand your question, if we made it clear that this was a priority that and teachers would be held accountable, yes, they would.
And you as an administrator, if you felt that this was important in your district, you would push to see that it was included in the curriculum.
Yes.
I'm going somewhere with all of this.
Yes, Representative Dolan, yes.
And if your board thought that the children in your community needed career education, would they pass board policy requiring that?
Representative Dolan, I believe they would.
Is there a follow-up?
No, I want to establish the point that we have professionals in the classroom. We have professionals in the district office, in the school office. We have elected officials that will see to it that the students in their community get the best education possible. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, in my opinion. Thank you.
Madam Chair? I'm sorry, I do have a follow-up. It took me a minute to assimilate the information, but what I'm wondering is, how is it that school administrators would not know that those core subjects had been reduced to three?
Representative Farr, I'm going to refer back to the first page of my handout, the Certificate of Initial Mastery. A achieve all grade 10 performance standards in the academic content standards areas of English, mathematics, science, and the social studies, and additional local district SIM requirements, if any, as defined by district board policy. Social sciences, I believe, is still included.
Jim?
I just noticed she's making reference to the Oregon administrative rule. I was talking about statute.
I apologize for the confusion.
Well, now I'm even more confused. So please indulge me for a moment. Can you explain to me, is everyone else confused as well?
No.
I just am, can you explain to me what is required to obtain your SIM? Because my understanding was that it was English, math, and science.
If it's all right, I'd like to ask Salam, Noor, and maybe Randy Harnish.
I want to let the former Representative Farr know that his work was important.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we have a situation where the administrative rule process has not fully caught up with the changes and the revisions in the statutes. In fact, relative to House Bill 2744, the legislature made those modifications to the requirements in the Certificate of Initial Mastery last, in the last session, where students now can earn a Certificate of Initial Mastery in Math, Science, and Language Arts, and there are some requirements clearly spelled out relative to what the student is required to do in order to earn that certificate. House Bill 2744 established what's called subject area endorsements. So a student can actually earn a certificate of initial mastery in subject area endorsements in social studies, physical education, health, and the arts. And in fact, the board, the State Board of Education, just last month took action on the performance requirements that the legislation directed the department to develop. And the performance requirements is basically the level of performance that a student is expected to demonstrate in order to be eligible to receive those certificates. And you're absolutely right, it's actually a may rather than a shall. We've been working on that for over a year now, and the State Board of Education took action on it last month to make it optional for local districts to offer those opportunities for their students. And we're in the process actually of sending out the numbered memorandum that will communicate that in policy, if you will, to all districts throughout the state, and then allow us to go through the rule revision process, which often takes anywhere from, typically it takes about 90 days. I hope that helps clarify the concerns and the questions about the modifications to this SIM.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. So, in fact, as a superintendent sitting there, the OAR administrative rules have just as much standing as the law with respect to the job. And so, regardless if the law has changed, since the administrative rules haven't changed, their requirements were still in place exactly as they were before.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, the only difference I would suggest is communicated from the department through a numbered memorandum. So we rely on numbered memorandums as official notification to districts that the law has changed and that we're in the process of developing rules to address those modifications. So if a notification does go out from the department, that becomes the current policy that the district must adhere to instead of the existing OER.
Representative,
has that notification gone out?
The memo?
To the superintendent?
The memo that I, Madam Chair, Representative Dunham, that we're in the process of crafting that memo right now. It was adopted at the January board meeting to give districts the option to offer subject area endorsements. And it clarifies their requirements and obligations to students. And it clarifies the shall versus may, if you will. And it should be going out hopefully in the next couple of weeks.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Is this a normal flow time from legislation to drafting administrative rule? Is this normal, or is this long or short, or how does this stack up with other legislative tools or legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Bellum, I don't mean to pass.
pass the buck.
From our perspective, The legislation directed us to take this in a different direction that we were actually pursuing relative to the Certificate of Initial Mastery. So it took us some time to interpret the legislation, to understand the intent behind the legislation, and to do the internal work, and also we involve our external partners in the process. So that does take time. But usually, to respond to the normal time for going from a legislative from legislation to rule, Randy actually probably has more experience with that than I do.
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, I would say this probably did take longer than it normally does.
For the record, please.
Randy. Oh, I'm sorry. Randy Harnish with the Department of Education. Unfortunately, or when we read the bill after it passed in 2003, we thought we understood the language that was in the law. And as is often the case, and I hope I'm not maligning too many attorneys when I say this, but when we got our legal counsel involved, what we thought we understood, we soon realized that we weren't necessarily sure that we understood. So we've spent a lot of time actually with our legal counsel at the Attorney General's office very carefully analyzing that language so that we were absolutely certain that the rules that we devised were meeting the legislative intent and the language in the statute. And that's the process, and that's where we are at this point, is with that clarification, ready to move forward and adopt the administrative rules.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Superintendent Bedard, had you had this information at the start of this school term, would that have impacted students and how they plan their curriculum and how they plan to meet their SIM requirements?
Madam Chairman and Representative Dahlem, I'm not sure so much it would have impacted students, especially as they move through their high school career. They hopefully plan it out starting as freshmen, but it would have given us some time to begin thinking with teachers about the focus for their expectations and their lessons. And frankly, this is very good news, and I'm sorry that we weren't keeping up.
But then that would have given your staff a lot more latitude in how they work with students in meeting their high school and SIM requirements?
Representative Dahlem, I don't think it would have created a wide space of extra teaching time. We continue to teach social studies classes, provide a rich environment for students to learn. It would have shifted our thinking about how we're held accountable for students with regard to the Certificate of Initial Mastery. At this time in Albany, the Certificate of Initial Mastery is not a requirement for graduation. So I'm not saying that we were hamstrung by not knowing this.
Madam Chair.
Representative March had a question, and I'll move
back.
Thank you.
And this is for the department. I'm a little troubled by this, seeing as the law would have gone into effect 90 days after the close of session in 2003, which would have meant it went into effect by January of 2004. This is January of 2005. In the interim period, did you contact either the author of that legislation or the committee staff about what the legislative intent was?
Chair Flores, Representative March, we were in regular contact with Mr. Keller throughout that process as far as the intent.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I was not directly in contact, but we did communicate with districts immediately after the passing of that legislation that the requirements for the Certificate of Initial Mastery has changed, and the State Board took action to communicate that in policy as well by changing the requirements for those three specific areas. So we did communicate publicly with districts that their responsibilities and obligations for the Certificate of Initial Mastery have been changed. At the time, and actually repeatedly afterwards, we did communicate to districts and other partners in the field, because we wanted to solicit their input into this process, that we are in the process of interpreting House Bill 2744 and developing a timeline and expectations relative to the requirements in House Bill 2744. And also, if I may add, the reason I think, and there's really no excuse for us to to have taken this long, except it's just the process was much more involved than we actually anticipated. We had four subject areas that we needed to develop performance qualifications for, which also means we have four constituent groups. We have four groups of teachers and concerned citizens that deal with those four areas, the arts, physical education, health, and social studies, that we also needed to work with to solicit their input. So it takes us a little bit longer because we really want to be inclusive and we want to get as much input into our thinking and our decision making as much as we possibly can. What complicates it a little bit also is our work with the state board. Since this also requires a state board decision, we have to take the item to them for review, we have to take it back for a first reading, we take it out for public input, we bring it back for a second reading, and then once action has been taken on that item, it becomes policy and it gets communicated in the form of a number memorandum. So it's, I just wanted to share that with you to just describe how convoluted this process can get at times, but it's really it's done with the best of intentions to get the best results. In fact, we've had internal debates relative to House Bill 2744, and I really appreciate your suggestion, and we should have actually consulted the authors of that bill, because some of our staff were thinking that it should be a shell, that districts must do this. Some of our staff members felt that it should be in May, because that's really what the law says. And some basically commented about the committee's intent, that the committee's intent was actually a shell rather than a May. We took it out to our partners in the field and said, help us interpret this. How do you react to it? And after we've gathered all that input, we decided to seek the Attorney General's opinion on it. And his interpretation was that it's a May rather than a shell. And that provided us all the information that we needed to take it to the State Board of Education and recommend a sound decision on it, recommend action on it. So it's just the process gets really involved at times, and in our interest in getting the best result, it takes us a little bit longer.
Mr. Neuer, what was the context then of the memo that you sent out to the school districts upon the passage of this legislation indicating that things had changed?
Well, that was... Madam Chair, that was after the State Board, going back a couple of years, after the State Board of Education adjusted the requirements for the Certificate of Initial Mastery to include only math, science, and language arts, as opposed to all areas, all seven areas, that was communicated with districts to inform them of that change. Our communication...
At what point in time?
I really don't know exactly what the date is. I do recall from... I don't recall the specific date, but I can get you that information. But I do recall the State Board of Education involved in conversations that were going on at a time parallel to the legislative session to make those changes in anticipation, actually, of a change in legislation on the one hand, but at the same time, to align our system with the federal system, if you will, because the federal... the No Child Left Behind specifically measure a student's performance in math, science, and language arts. So we wanted to make some adjustments to align the systems and streamline them as much as we possibly can. But I can, Madam Chair, I'll be more than happy to go back and look at the communication that we had with districts from that point on.
I would appreciate that, and perhaps a copy of that communication would be very helpful if you could provide that to Mr. Keller. Representative Farr and then Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that in looking back, because I was actually a staff person in the former Representative Farr's office, and he was Vice Chair of Education, and I seem to remember that there was an amendment made to the original bill changing the language from shall to may. There was a record number of amendments to that bill, but I do specifically remember photocopying off an amendment that specifically talked about the language change.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the other issues that we talk about with these mandates that come not just to the school districts but also to the Department of Ed, you had mandates in which you would find the criteria for assessment for each of the seven areas originally. Those mandates didn't change. You still had to find assessments for social studies, PE, and all of those. And that creates the need to spend a considerable amount of money developing those, because we develop our own in our state as opposed to other things. That continued. It didn't change with this bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I believe the bill directed the department to establish performance qualifications but not necessarily establish a statewide assessment for those four areas. So we're trying to be thoughtful in terms of how we communicate that to districts and to really encourage them to use the local assessment that many districts have developed over the years, because some of these areas were actually in the original legislation, some of these areas were actually locally assessed. So the state was not responsible for developing a statewide system in some categories. If I may, anyway, thank you.
You didn't want to go deeper, huh? I would just reiterate the concern that Representative March expressed, that it 2003, it is now February, actually, of 2005, and the time delay in getting to some resolution, when it seems that an early memo pending the adoption or the formulation of everything that Oregon Department of Education required and the implementing administrative rules would have been helpful to schools in realigning their planning in a more timely and efficient manner, in what I would call efficient manner. That's concerning. I think it should be concerning to all of us, and I guess you've already heard that and understand that, so it would do no good to continue down that trail, but I had to express it. Any further questions for the superintendent or... Well, thank you for that.
Thank you for your time.
It was lively. And I think, Salam, before we have you and Mr. Harnish present, I would like to have Mark Jeffrey come forward from Paisley.
Do you want to stay there, just in case? You want to stay up there just in case?
Or you could stay up there just in case.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Mark Jeffrey. I'm superintendent principal of Paisley School District. We're a very small district of 67 students, K-12. We're located about 2.5 hours southeast of Bend along Highway 37 in Lake County. We serve the communities of Paisley and Summer Lake. And I have been asked to come, I believe, to share some insights from the perspective of the first charter district in the state, and I hope also from the perspective of one of the very small districts. I distinguish, at least in my mind, the small from very small, in that there are about 6 districts that run K-12 programs and have less than 80 students. And our needs and the impacts of statutory requirements are a lot different, and I think have a more immediate and larger impact on us because of our lack of economies of scale. I was visiting recently with a friend of mine who teaches in the Springfield School District, and he was mentioning that he has a classroom with 42 students and they didn't have enough desks, so some of the students are sitting in chairs, and I had to laugh because I couldn't put together 45 students to stick in a single classroom without including some of my elementary all the way through my high school. We currently have 27 students in our 9th through 12th grades, and then I have 2 7th graders, which is my smallest class. And in my first year there, our very first kindergarten graduation had 1 student, so it was a brief but well-attended ceremony. We are, I think our needs are not unique. The issues that we've dealt with, I've been at Paisley for about 4 years now. I left a middle school classroom in 2000 in June, and that same day my last day teaching was my first board meeting, and we were faced that year with the loss of about $283,000 out of about a $1.1 million budget, and over the next 2 years that number grew to well over $350,000. That was difficult. I started with a staff of about 27. I'm down now to a staff of about 17, and of those, one is quarter-time, two are part-time, or half-time, excuse me, and one of the half-time, half of that half or a quarter is volunteer. So we have worked very hard at being as efficient as we can with state funds, and I believe that we have one of the the finest staffs in the state. I have a single teacher that does our K-3, also working with an aide. They pick up a preschool program that wasn't available in our little community. I have one staff member that does our 4 through 6. I have a single staff member that does social studies and English, 7 through 12. Another that does 7 through 12 math and science. I have a teacher that does runs our Voc Ag program, because in Paisley that's one of our core classes. Everyone takes Voc Ag. She also helps us with running our high school PE program every other year. We alternate that with health in the off year, along with some other requirements. I have a quarter-time special ed teacher. I have two registered teachers, which are one of the options under charter. One of those is a full-time that works basically K through 12 in a variety of programs, and then another that assists us in our PE. She does elementary PE, and then works our fifth through eighth grade intramural program. So we have learned a lot in this process and looked at a lot of things. Oddly enough, what I think may have prompted my invitation, one of the things is that I was maybe one of the first ones to mention that one of the unfunded or underfunded mandates was the very thing that emphasized us the need for us to go charter, and that was the idea of a media specialist. And again, in a district our size and in a dispersed county like Lake County, we're 45 miles from Lakeview, which is the next nearest school district, and 50 miles from the North Lake School District, which is our next nearest neighbor. It is difficult at best to locate personnel that have the certification to do those positions. I was fortunate that my English teacher had a media endorsement. However, when we went through the initial reductions in staff that first year, she graciously consented to go to halftime. And my concern was I wanted four periods of English as opposed to three periods of English and one of library. And so I came as a very new superintendent to visit with the folks at the Department of Ed, because coming out of the classroom, we're always taught as teachers that there's a vault of money that the Department of Ed has, and when you're in trouble as a district, they just open it up and give it to you. And then failing that, we were certain that the legislature had that vault. We just weren't able to find it in that first year. So we took our list of cuts and visited with the Department of Ed, and I slid my cuts across the table and visited with as we were having our meeting, and it was slid right back to me and said that if you make these cuts, you'll be out of compliance. And I said, well, I assumed it was because I was closing my cafeteria, because that was one of the other cuts we were making at that time. And when I was informed that it was my media specialist, I was amazed by that it was that significant. I understand the importance of libraries and the importance of certified librarians, but was flabbergasted that in an effort to provide as much English as we could, we were being asked to eliminate another hour of English to have a library period. So that kind of, from that meeting, we went right in and met with Joni Gillis, who at the time was responsible for overseeing charter schools for the Department of Ed, and had a wonderful visit, got involved in that process. Again, being young and naive at the time, I thought that it was about April, I think, when we started the process. I was sure that following August we would open as a charter school, because our concern was with the funding losses that we had faced, we wouldn't be open much longer if we didn't do something. It took us 18 more months, and again, an additional $100,000 to $150,000 in lost revenue. And again, that's a common story, I think, from all districts going through those years. And we opened we've been about 18 months now as a chartered district, and it has been more than we had anticipated it would be. I'll be honest with you that charter purists look at charter schools as, you know, they're usually created by innovative outsiders, folks who look at public education and say it can be made better if we. And a lot of times they have struggles with the districts to get started, and there is that issue. But in our case, we had the support of our staff, of our school board, and of most of our community. And so it was a completely different environment for us. It was really more a matter of how do we make it work. Because as we looked at Paisley, we realized that we were what a lot of charter schools want to be. We had a very low teacher-to-student ratio. We had very good test results. We had everything going for us. course, but the ability to survive. And charter made that possible. And we had anticipated, obviously, the infusion of the federal grant dollars being a benefit to us. But what we've come to realize, really, more important than that, because they only last 2 years, that the opportunity to restructure the way we run our school and to be more efficient, to be innovative, and to have the flexibility to lay aside some of those Division 22 standards, we can now function, and the superintendent can sleep better at night because his district's closer to compliance than it's ever been. So I really am here to answer your questions. We are, I think, a unique district, and we have 67 outstanding young students that deserve to have an education in their community. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jeffrey,
yes.
Then clarify for me. So then is a charter district subject to all of the same mandates or Division 22 mandates as any other public school?
Madam Chair, we're not. We are allowed to lay aside most of Division 22. There are certain restrictions. Some of those, there is a booklet called the Charter School Handbook that's available through the Department of Ed that has the full list. But we still have to adopt textbooks in the same manner. All federal legislation, we're still required to follow testing. We are still mandated to do. We, by choice, aligned our curriculum to the SIM because it's, for us, a very efficient system. I don't know if you're familiar with the newspaper that comes out every year or so that lists all of the benchmarks and those supporting materials, but for us, in small rural districts, certainly teacher turnover is just common. And that's the way it is. We are by nature fairly low paying, and it is difficult to retain staff long term. One of the problems is that as you gain and lose a teacher, they each have interests, and the program radically changes each time that happens. And we felt that by aligning to the benchmarks, that the curriculum would stay even as the staff came and went, so that we would have the opportunity to provide a consistent education for our students. And then as you articulate kindergarten through 12th grade, you're really... We're working at that, and it's still bumpy, but eventually we want to have a seamlessly articulated curriculum where the kids build all the way through, and that as we lose and gain staff through a departure and through retirement, the programs stay in place, because I think the thought that went into the work for the SIM is solid. I mean, the information that's listed there and the way it's presented, I think, is very strong. So we, unlike some other districts, and I'm speaking again from the perspective of a very small district, we are advocates of the SIM, and we have developed some very strong CAMs, so hopefully I've answered your question. No?
I think so. Thank you. Any other questions?
You've been working at becoming a charter school for 18 months with the board in agreement, the staff in agreement, the community mostly supportive, the administration in agreement. Why has it taken 18 months?
Well, let me clarify. It took us 18 months to work through the process. We have been operating as a charter district for 18 months now. It took us 18 months to establish it as a charter district, and now we have been operating. This is our second year as a charter district. And really the biggest hang-up that we ran into was trying to figure out the governance structure. In a small community, it's important that you don't overburden your community members with another board to serve on or another committee to be involved in, because most of those who serve do serve either through the service organizations, their churches, or on the school board or budget committee, and did not have a wealth of folks to fulfill those roles who weren't already active. So we worked through that process again with the Department of Ed and with Jim Green at OSBA and came up with the structure that we now have. We have functioned as the first charter district now all of last year, and then this year Camas Valley joined us as the second charter district in the state. So,
Representative Farr, then Representative Shear.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask you a question because I know that one of the issues for you was the requirement of providing lunch and breakfast to students. So you separated out from the USDA program prior to becoming a charter district. How does that work out for you now? Does every student in your district come to school with a lunch prepared from home daily?
I appreciate that question, Madam Chair. Representative Farr, we are blessed in our small community with people who are used to stepping up and serving, and it was one of my concerns, and I knew that as we made those tough decisions to eliminate the lunch program and yet keep athletics, it seemed counterintuitive. The studies would show that both are important, but that maybe a good breakfast is more important than good athletics. However, in a small community like ours, where we know every student, that's an advantage and a disadvantage because everyone knows your business, no matter who you are. It was apparent to us that we knew the students that we needed to keep an eye on, and we made sure in that first year that, just the first quarter of that year, that we would have food provided in some form. And if they needed, they could just come and get it. And we made that announcement, and any kid could. And the kids have figured that out, and some of them forget their lunch on a regular basis now. So the other thing that happened was exactly what charter schools are about, and that's this innovative nature. And we had a group of members of the community who stepped up and went out and wrote a grant and received money to provide on a limited basis breakfasts and lunches to our kids, and we provide them the space, and they provide the volunteers and the food stores, and they take care of that now. So all of our kids are eating. I forget how many meals they served last year, but a significant number of the elementary take advantage of that program. Most of our high school kids go uptown to eat two blocks away, and the restaurant and a store there provide them with specials. So, and then some of them come back and avail themselves of the lunch program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if there was a difference between teacher job retention before you became a charter district versus after?
I can say that I had two staff members who at about the same time received jobs that they had been waiting for a long time. One of them much closer to the home, and the other was in the community that she had been anticipating a job from. I mean, it's one of the places she had went and looked. Both of them assured me at the time it had nothing to do with the changes, though the changes were significant. One of them was my original science teacher who was going to have to become science and math, and that's a daunting thing to do, and it's still one of the things I worry about the most. We were able to replace that teacher with a very competent new teacher, but again, with teacher turnover, I don't know if I'm going to continually be able to find people who can do that, and it may well be that we'll modify our structure and separate math and science again, just because it's so difficult to find people who, again, fall into the NCLB highly qualified in both areas. So, but we haven't seen that. I was able to hire two very good teachers to replace them. So retention is always an issue in the small districts, partly because of the pay structure and partly because we're an isolated, remote area to live. Again, it's 2.5 hours to Bend, and that's really where the nearest shopping is, other than Lakeview, which is an hour south. But as far as the larger stores, they're not present there.
So is the pay structure significantly different between the previous situation in the charter district now?
Chair Flores, Representative Shields, no. We have negotiated with our we still have a union representation for our certified. However, the classified on their own have moved not to be represented by the union. We have two of the last 3 years the staff has agreed to take no cost of living raise and took only their step increases to assist the district. Again, I have this phenomenal staff that I don't know I can find just anywhere else. They've been very supportive of our needs. We made the we opened the budget to them in that first year in 2000 and explained what was happening, and they they understood it. It's one thing to understand it. It's another when you're sitting across from the superintendent and losing your position. So it's been difficult, but those staff that I have right now have been very supportive of that. So no, our pay scale has not changed. We put that money not into teacher salaries, but into things like new textbooks and science instruments. And yes, it has been reported that we bought cows with that money, and we did indeed. So we own a cattle ranch of sorts.
That's so. Kind of the Volk egg.
Yes, they're large lab rats. So,
there we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the percentage of the federal government grant to this charter school? What's the percentage of it, and how much is it?
The grant for the charter school, there's a $50,000, and these numbers I'm using, I think, have changed since we came through that door and started working on this. 3 years ago, we received $50,000 to develop the programs and to see if it would work for us, and that was very helpful. And then we received $150,000 last year, and we'll receive $150,000, excuse me, this year, and that will be it. We then have to sustain our programs on our own. So, and what we have, again, the restructuring that consolidated those positions and some other changes. And we also run a dormitory for exchange students who live in our community to help augment our enrollment and to allow our students an international experience. So we currently have students from various countries in the world living in Paisley. So that was the federal money involved in that.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I understand federal government program, you are contracted for 2 years, something like that. And then what happened if the federal government funding gone away? Are you still able to continue as a charter school?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, one of the things you have to do in order to become charter is show that you're sustainable after that 2 years, and that really is the critical issue. With the flexibility that charter offered us, even though we are a continually declining enrollment district, up until this last year has been gradually declining. It accelerated somewhat this summer. But we believe that under the current structure we have, that we have the funding necessary to get through the next 2 years. It gets, unfortunately, that's drawing down our reserves to do that. And the issues have nothing to do with charter. They have everything to do with the fact that our dollars are connected to the number of students we have, and there is that critical number of students where you just can't operate. Even though I have 67 students left in about the next 2.5 years, if we don't receive some solution to that issue, even if I maintain those 67 kids, we will not be able to operate. The next job that's on the line is mine. It's very likely that we'll have to find some other administrative structure.
Okay, so to make my it comment function. Is, Madam Chair, that the future is not quite clear, and the funding sources is not clear. The continuation of education for the children is not clear. We might have some problem in the future, including your job.
Absolutely.
Very succinct summation, Representative Lim. Thank you very much. There are no other questions for Mr. Jeffrey. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you all very much.
Batting cleanup today. Thank you very much, Mr. Snuer and Harnish, for being available to help enhance our discussion as we've gone forward. But you probably would like to present to us as well. But if you don't want to, it's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we really had not planned on making a formal presentation. We wanted to have the opportunity to respond to questions and comments that the committee might have, to provide some clarifications relative to the rules that are currently on the books, if you will, and share with you the process that we propose to go through to help make some of these modifications and revisions that have been suggested to us from the field and things that we've been thinking about for quite some time now. So we can proceed at your will.
Are there any additional questions for either? Can you tell us, are there any additional Oregon administrative rules that have not yet been updated as a result of any other legislative changes?
Madam Chair, I'm not really aware of any. There are so many administrative rules that I can't really speak to all of them.
The
set of rules that we can address today are Division 22 requirements. And Division 22 requirements, as has been very eloquently stated by Mr. Marshall, define what a standard school is, define what a standard district is, and help establish uniformity across all schools and districts in terms of the education that we provide to our students. We're fully cognizant that Division 22 requirements have not been updated for quite some time, have not gone through a massive, if you will, or a large-scale update and revision for many years. We've been updating them and reflecting changes, if you will. For example, the change to the Certificate of Initial Mastery has been reflected in these rules to say that it's math, science, and language arts. changes for the certificate of advanced mastery have been reflected in those rules to spell out the requirements for students and what districts ought to do to help students achieve those certificates. What hasn't been done, in our view, is really a thorough analysis of the rules that currently exist in a holistic fashion to say, are these rules relevant? Are they current? Do they really reflect what's needed in our education system today? Do they reflect the needs of a 21st century education and the challenges that we're facing today? A case in point is a media specialist. Is a media specialist absolutely integral to a child's development and education? So we think we have an opportunity to look at these rules in a very holistic fashion, do an analysis, do the research, and engage our external partners, COSA, OSBA, and many other partners in the field, to look at education as it currently exists in the state today and be futuristic in our approach as well to say what kinds of rules we want to have in place that help inform the education that our students receive, that our children receive. So that's really what we're prepared to do. We've had a small internal group of three staff members that worked with Randy that started to go through the rules and started to do a preliminary analysis in terms of what's really crucial, what's sort of nice to have but it's not absolutely essential for a child's education, and what's really outdated and we don't need to even think about it and consider it because it doesn't apply in today's climate, in today's educational environment. Our next step is really to expand that group and invite some external partners to help us go through these rules one by one and gain the benefit of their expertise and wisdom as we look at the rules, and also look at our interpretations of the rules as a department, because many of these rules are an interpretation of statutes, but that interpretation occurred 10, 15, in some cases 20 years ago. We need to basically look at those one more time and make sure that they are current and truly reflect what was the intent of that legislation, and look at what might have changed in legislation over the course of the last 20 years as well.
Just by way of commentary, what you described is, in reviewing what you're doing, and if you should be doing it, and what is the most critical, is are the essential components of a core functions analysis. And given that we have been in a mode of moving to education crisis, are you on any fast track for this further review?
Madam Chair, yes.
And do you care to speculate on what that timeline might look like?
Madam Chair, absolutely. What we plan to do and hope to be able to accomplish in the next 6 months at least is to form a task force involving both internal and external stakeholders. We are actually hoping to contract with a retired superintendent that can actually help us with the work that we want to do. And hopefully within the next six months, be able to report to you, hopefully, that we've looked at the rules and we have a set of recommendations based on input from the field, some research and studying and analysis that we have done ourselves, and to proceed based on that. The challenge that we have is that as we revise the rules, the legislature is in session and may actually be in the process of crafting new statutes that we also have to reflect in the rulemaking process.
Could be.
So so I just wanted to share with you that we are very much concerned about this as much as you are, and we've had conversations with several of our partners in the field, and we've made a commitment to address it, and we will try to fast track it as much as we possibly can. In the next, if you find the timeline agreeable to you, we will proceed with a task force that starts working on this as soon as possible, and hopefully come back and report to you in a couple of months where we're at.
I would very much like to have a report on where you are in your planning within the next month or 6 weeks, and hopefully we'll be out by the end of June, so I'm not sure you're going to be done, but we'll see. We can go further on that.
I'd like to ask the status of the Oregon Education Act, and will ask you that, where the Oregon Education Act fits into your review of the rules, both in spirit and in letter. So when you come back, I'll be looking for that.
And then along with that, you will be undertaking a wholesale review from its inception forward. Mr. Harnish is nodding concurrence, at least.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I think the one caution I would like to suggest relative to the timeline is that Division 22 spills into other areas that we have to be careful of. Division 22, that was the preliminary analysis that our staff did. Is when you start looking at Division 22, you can't help but get into Division 21. You get into Division 15 with rules relative to special education. So we want to do this in a very thoughtful and methodical manner. And we don't want to make one adjustment in one set of rules and have them adversely impact another set of rules. For example, changes in Division 22 may touch on transportation. That has a whole set of consequences associated with it. So we want to be really deliberate and purposeful in terms of how to do this. And we will be happy to come back to you with a report.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Chair Flores, I could add just one minute. One of the reasons that we suggested that you hear from Mr. Jeffries from Paisley and from Dr. Biedorf from Albany is because of the experience that they have looking at the concept of mandates. Mr. Jeffrey, particularly from his with his experience working at a charter school, freed from some of those mandates and the ability to then go back and look at the charter school law as possibly a starting place for the prioritization of rules that you commented on in your opening remarks. I think that's kind of where we would like to begin and put that information in front of the task force that Salam was referring to, and will hopefully put us a few miles down the road in this process.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your time and taking a little bit of heat.
Thank you.
If there is no other business to come before this committee, we will be adjourned.